Good morning, everyone. It's Sunday, February 27th, 2011. Backtracking a few hundred years from last week, where we talked about David Berger versus Chabad, you know, thought it was a nice contrast with the week before that about the Vilna Gaon and the Vilna Gaon versus Chassidut. So here on out, my intent for the class is going to discuss responsa. In the modern period, you find many, I shouldn't say many more halachic works, but you will find responsa being published, certainly either a lot more frequently or things that we have a lot more access to, where rabbis are responding to very specific cases and specific instances. Yes, you still have every now and again like a big halachic corpus out there, but for the most part, I shouldn't say for the most part, forget the generalities, but you have we have available to us rabbis responding to very direct specific questions and specific issues. It makes it a little bit difficult for translating purposes because in these tshuvot, you'll see like there's a four-page tshuva. I didn't even come close to translating the whole thing because I had no idea how to do it coherently. It will often make references to previous authorities, either Gemaras, to Rishonim, to depending on when you're writing Achronim, and there are a lot of inline footnotes that are just given as references, where it's one of these things of, you know, either assuming that you know what they're talking about, or, you know, if you don't know what they're talking about, you need to go back and do the research behind it, and to really understand, well, what's the logic here, what's the logic there. So for our purposes,
It's not that not bother doing the follow-up.
The truth is, the research is crucially important. There was one professor at Yeshiva University who, if he would sign a reading that made references, and you didn't actually do the homework and check up those references, would consider it as if you didn't do the proper reading, and if you weren't prepared, he would either throw you out of class or walk out himself. So it's not that I don't want to. You might argue that I don't necessarily have the time to, but in terms of giving a class, it makes it very difficult and choppy. Because it's what might seem as a parenthetical point to the general theme that we're trying to cover, you know, we could probably give a full class just to understand this one or two line reference may or may not matter. So from a pedagogic purpose, we'll have to try and see. Also, I'm not as used to reading some teshuvot than others. Like, for Gemara, you know, it's something I spent a lot more time learning Gemara than responsa. And even when you spend time learning responsa, different people have different writing styles. Some I find much easier to understand. I personally think it's much easier to understand Rav Avadya Yosef than Rav Moshe Feinstein, partially because Rav Avadya Yosef's Hebrew is a lot better, being a native speaker. One thing that's really funny when you get to Rav Moshe Feinstein, we'll see this, we do some of his response. We saw it last year, too. He does a lot of transliteration. And sometimes you really have to hack out these Hebrew characters when he's not talking Hebrew, he's talking English. Like cars as Kuf Ayin Reish Samech, and trying to look, and you have to sound it out. So today's responsa actually got from this book that was recommended to me by a friend of mine, Menachem Butler. Mentioned to someone earlier about people who are very well read. My friend Menachem Butler is really astoundingly well read. I'm not sure what else he does other than read. I know he does other stuff. He's the head mashgiach at Prime KO, Midtown Steakhouse. But anyway, he reads a lot on a whole lot of things. And he recommended to me this book when discussing the modern period. It's called Exclusion and Hierarchy by Adam Furtziker. It's called Orthodoxy, Non-Observance, and the Emergence of Modern Jewish Identity. And there was a response in here I thought that was fascinating in its own right, and I'll explain why he thought so. And I call this, Politics of Exclusion, Sephardim versus Ashkenazim, which is not entirely correct in terms of, are we talking about a fight of like Sephardim Minhagim versus Ashkenazi Minhagim? But by saying it's Sephardim versus Ashkenazim, makes it a little bit sexier, and people will say like, ha ha, they actually have a fight there. Or truth be told, you've got Rav Avadya Yosef that deals with certain responsa of, well, what's someone who has a Sephardi tradition, how is he supposed to act in an Ashkenazi shul, or vice versa?
to explain here, as Herzegger puts it, he says, the response that we're going to cover here deserves consideration for a number of reasons. First, it appears to be the first source from the 18th century, which an Ashkenazic authority analyzed the halachic status of a group of Jews who were neither baptized apostates nor Sabbateans, but rather identifying Jews who openly did not live according to Jewish law. Now, the fact that the individuals here happen to be Spartan is, I don't think, a crucial point here, although we can see that the argument could be extended today. If you are Sephardi versus or an Ashkenazi, your conception of what Jewish law is going to be drastically different, to the point where Ashkenazim can say, you, Mr. Sephardi, aren't keeping halacha well, and the Sephardim will do the same back. To give one example of a modern-day tension that this happened, community in Seattle. For those people who are here might find it amusing, most of the Jews in Seattle, I shouldn't say, big Jewish community in Seattle lives in a neighborhood called Seward Park, not unlike the name of the co-op down here. And there's a very big Sephardi and Ashkenazi community that lives interspersed with each other. And by Sephardi community, I don't mean Spanish per se. If I'm remembering correctly, the quote Sephardi shul is really follows a Turkish tradition. And I think it's one of the last shuls anyone will find that really follows that tradition. And the Chazan, I think the Chazan Ezos, is very instrumental in, they have their own Sidur and all that. And both shuls are called Bikur Cholim. They're side by side or a block away from each other. And there was an issue one year of someone in the Ashkenazi shul saying, don't eat by the Sephardim for Pesach because of the whole Kitnio thing or whatnot. So point is, you have an interesting case here that we're going to discuss where you've got a complaint of one group of Jews versus another group of Jews, both of whom are saying that they're Jewish. You have different traditions of what does it mean to be different traditions. We can see here maybe the observance isn't all that great involved, but it's an interesting distinction that we haven't seen as of yet of a group of Jews who just aren't observant. Not necessarily institutionally, not that they say that you don't have to be, but they're just not. And how would that play into matters? So even though you might argue that the extrapolation to Sephardim or Ashkenazim might be misguided, I think colloquially it is important simply because there's so much debate on Jewish law. It's not too hard to say, well, you guys aren't keeping Jewish law correctly. Heck, even in an Ashkenazi shul, you can say, well, yeah, they're too left-wing, they're not keeping halacha right. Or they're too right-wing and they're getting all this stuff wrong, although that doesn't happen as often as it probably should. Anyway. Sure.
When is the modern?
So by modern, in terms of exactly when to start, hard to say. What I will define it as, let's say post-medieval, today's response comes from, let's say, the 1600s or so. When I really speak of modern, I speak of more contemporary, let's say 17, more like 18, 1900s. So I'm painting that with a really broad brush as opposed to medieval that was, we would consider Middle Ages. And, yeah, I'm being intentionally vague. We spend a lot more time, say, contrasting it to, say, the rabbinic period or, say, the time of the Talmud, biblical period, time of the Bible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the other question I had was, can you need to touch upon, there's a Greek tradition, like Camarillo, some things that don't fall into either camp.
So this is because history was written by the victors, which happened to have been Ashkenazim. If you study Ashken, and by which I mean all of those things which would tend to be grouped in together as Sephardi in some way, it is ethnically and culturally incorrect and probably really insulting. If you were raised Ashkenazi, you probably may be aware of different customs that came out of different regions in Europe. Like, oh, that was a French custom maybe, or that came from Germany. Whereas Sephardim, you'll group together. It doesn't matter if you were Turkish, Greek, Moroccan, Syrian, Iraqi, Egyptian, or Iranian. right? Each one of those, you know, communities I mentioned have their own unique traditions. You might have certain similarities to them, but being, you know, sort of Ashkenazified, or however you want to call it, because we don't really deal... I think that there's a certain degree of xenophobia where if you're not like one of us, we sort of like don't, you know, take you that seriously, that it's very easy for us to say, oh yeah, they're all Sephardim, which is just wrong. I mean, historically wrong, culturally wrong, but because culturally in Ashkenazim we have not been trained to accept those nuances, they're not part of our cultural world, we might not recognize them. So, are there people who don't fall into that category? Yes and no. From an Ashkenazi perspective, it's easy for us to just lump them all together. But from a more socially accurate perspective, the Greek tradition would be different than the Iraqi tradition, and you wouldn't call them all Sephardim. You would actually be a lot more precise to say, this is Persian, this is Syrian, this is Egyptian. And I apologize for doing so, just, you know, for the purposes of dialogue, it makes things, you know, a little bit easier. You could speak to Ami in our show about that, because he gets really livid, and he's absolutely right.
He's not Sephardi.
Exactly. The word Sephardi literally means Spanish. Right, but you know, when you have, you know, which has very little, as opposed to say Eidot HaMizrah, right? And
but
yeah,
you're making like a cultural distinction, saying, oh, we should respect a little more the Egyptian, the Greek, but like legally and like in a codified way, would you say they have different legal traditions?
Oh, absolutely, than Ashkenazim. Oh,
yeah, like Greek,
different from each other.
Turkish.
Maybe
that's what the lumping together.
I don't. Do they have different legal traditions? I don't know. I honestly don't know. I'd have to do a whole lot more research in order to say that. Even if they have different manifestations, you might even say, argue that they have the same legal tradition. Like in Ashkenaz, you have, you know, you're going to have certain variants of Jewish law. Like the way things developed, say, in France might be a little bit different than Germany. But you could also argue that they were following the same legal tradition, just applying it differently. I don't know enough about the halachic developments about those areas. Yeah.
Do they have their own Shulchan Aruch?
No. Well, I mean, they don't. Okay. Or at least as far as I know. But I don't know if they have, like, you know, their own, there's a specific Turkish route that they followed as opposed to other people. I'm completely ignorant in that level. You see,
where do they go to settle?
You see, other people will, you know, if you're really interested in the Turkish Jewish community, I would inquire with the congregation Bikur Cholim in Seattle. I can say from personal experience, from both shuls actually, they're both really, really nice. And go visit Seattle. It's a nice place in Hike Mount Rainier.
Rambam would be in the Sephardic thing?
In a sense, I mean...
Because he's a heavy dude, I think, given the Ashkenazim.
So, I mean, he's part of the canon of... I mean, Ashkenazim will still take Rambam seriously. I would say people from the Eidot Mizrach tradition take Rambam a whole lot more seriously practicing Jewish law. Meaning, if I quote Rambam to, you know, someone like any of the Ashkenazi local shuls, they'll say, we don't follow the Rambam. You quote, you know, from someone from Eidot Mizrach, it's going to carry a lot more weight.
Gotcha.
By the same token, I actually give someone a lot of credit for this. This is a great moment in yeshiva. We had a token Sephardi rabbi speak, if I remember correctly, Rabbi Chaim Tusson, who's at Yeshiva University, and one of my classmates raised his hand and he said, well, how come Sephardim do X when the Mishnah Berurah says Y? And he caught himself, like, at the end where he said, oh, never mind, realizing that Sephardim don't really follow the Mishnah Berurah. It's not part of their tradition. So, you know, it's one of those questions like, what are you asking? But, you know, you caught himself enough, like, wait a second, that was stupid. Just, like, backtrack from it. So, anyway, so let's go on. So this is Chacham Tzvi. Put in Tshuva from the Chacham Tzvi, number 38 of his responsa. Put in a little biography here. Read the introduction.
Right, and this...
No, not the introduction. Intro. Yeah, just the intro.
Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch ben Jacob Ashkenazi, the Chacham Tzvi, and his name is...
So here's
Ashkenazi, and he's a Chacham, he's in both camps.
Well, that's cute.
Was born in Moravia in 1660 and studied there in his youth. In 1676, he was sent to Salonika, that's Greece,
mm-hmm.
to require the Sephardic approach to learning. During the years he spent in various Sephardic communities, he adopted many Sephardic customs and practices. He even accepted the Sephardic rabbinic title Chacham. He served as the rabbi of various Sephardic communities, as well as communities in Germany, Amsterdam, London, and Poland. His responsa reflect his wanderings and the many stormy affairs during his lifetime, including his staunch opposition to Sabbatai Tzvi. Ashkenazi died in Lemberg, Poland in 1718.
All right, so the bio here is from the Bar-Ilan CD. It gives us a nice little snapshot about time and place. The Chacham Tzvi usually is not quoted that often. The one thing that I think he's really well known for is the responsa that if you live outside of Israel and you go to Israel for one of the holidays, for Pesach, Sukkot, and, Shavuot and Sukkot, you only keep one day. Not many people have actually read it inside, you know, the rationale behind it, but it's probably the responsa for which he is most well known.
Most popular.
It's only become popular in the past couple of years. There's been a shift there. It used to, you know, culturally used to be whoever, who wrote that about that? Professor Aaron Chemish was talking to me about that. I don't know if he's written on it yet, but it was something he was thinking about. You know, that it's a sort of a modern day leniency where, right, 50 years ago, if you went to Israel, everyone kept 2 days no matter what. Nowadays, it's a lot more common or acceptable for people to keep 2 days. But anyway,
to keep one day.
To keep one day in Israel. So in this responsa, there's a huge long introduction that's I could only guess would be in Yiddish that I wasn't even going to attempt to translate. But fortunately, he does give us a little bit of a translation. Naomi, could you read what this question is?
The essence of the question, copied to our sacred language. One city where there was a synagogue designated for Spaniards, agreed under penalty of
Cherem. Yeah, excommunication.
Communication. Here was a minyan, a distance of 5 Persian miles, approximately 20 miles, the exception of the house of a room.
Let's stop there for a second. What it means is, they set up a shul. According to First Degree, seems to think that it's specific, that it refers to London. And they set up a thing that in this neighborhood, there's only going to be one shul, and they're not going to have any competing shuls for, you know, a certain radius, which they said, let's say, you know, 5 Persian miles or 20 miles total. The exception being, say, a Sheva Brachot, or the like, a halakha that is somewhat ignored today. Sheva Brachot are really supposed to be held in the groom's house. Birkat Chatanim Beveit Chatan, the Gemara Ketubot says. So what they used to do is that you would have the minyan, you know, where the groom got married. You can understand obvious reasons why this custom fell out of favor, because to tell a newlywed, you know, bride, like, oh yeah, you just got married, guess what? You're entertaining 10 people every day for a week. Won't go over so well. Even what if my most hardcore Sephardi friends could not have convinced his wife otherwise. But the point is, there are times when you're going to need a minyan, or say a shiva house, right? So aside from those things, you got a special decree not to have another competing shul. So continue. Under the penalty of chera, meaning excommunication.
Pretty heavy-handed stuff.
Yeah. Continue, though.
This?
Naomi.
Yeah, I'm showing her the place.
Thank you. This was initially due to the decree of the king, but afterwards, the government gave permission that each person the free have according to his own faith, thus the government would no longer risk the construction of more synagogues. And behold, after this, Ashkenazim came into the city and built for themselves shuls as they wished for their own reason. One Portuguese individual who left the Tenko communal synagogue to pray with the Ashkenazim chose to be a member in that community. And the Persian community...
Portuguese.
Not
Persian.
And the Portuguese community did not protest. The brave men from the Sephardic community were awoken by fear of God to leave their own congregation when they saw that sons of our nation who perform acts of not...
That should not. That's me not being able to type.
That should not take place among the Israelites. Attend prayer services there and go up to read from the Torah and participate in all the other rituals that are customary in the synagogue. It's been a thing that they and any
Stop. They should put a a pause. So here's your situation. You've got a synagogue where it's the only shul, only game in town, right? And they set up a takana, no other public assembly aside from ours. Now, you say it's heavy-handed. Apparently, the original reason had something to do with issues with the government. Let's face it, Jews in Europe didn't really have it that good for a long time. So they could say, well, look, we have permission to establish one synagogue. We are going to be the only synagogue. And it happened to have been a Spanish-Portuguese one, or fine. But once the government restrictions lapsed, then other shuls popped up. No one said anything. And there were people, though, who left the Spanish-Portuguese community to go to the Ashkenazi one, allegedly poor observance in the Sephardic ones, in the Spanish-Portuguese one. He says here that people are doing things that they shouldn't have been doing. So the question is, in the very last line, can the original theorem be applied in this case to ban the Ashkenazi shuls? In a sense where you've got people who are leaving the Sephardic shul to go to the Ashkenazi shul because in their mind what the Sephardic shul is doing is inappropriate, and would you be able to rely on the original theorem? Right? The original decree that was made not to have another shul, even though you hadn't really applied it up until now, does it still hold true?
Sounds to me like troublemakers come up with this kind of a thing. The guy already gave him, the king already said you can have other things. They're trying to resurrect an old takana, and it's like troublemaking.
In effect, okay. You think it's troublemaking because you have the legal authority to do so, now all of a sudden there's a problem.
Trying to drag up an old thing.
All right.
It's interesting that they don't have an issue with the fact that this other shul exists. They have an issue with the fact that people are being shipped from their shul.
So that is exactly. Now, if you want to pick like a general theme that we've been discussing a lot, from here, is you're going to have opposition when you feel that you have competition. If you don't feel that someone else is competition, you don't need to say anything about them, right? And, you've had that say with the Minim. Right. If there was any issue that if they were completely sectarian to the point where the sages didn't need to care about them, you wouldn't have had them criticizing them. Right. And, we'll see in a couple of weeks that if Orthodox Jews didn't really find that conservative Jews or Reformed Jews were a threat, wouldn't mention it at all. Or other shuls within a community. If you don't feel threatened by their existence, you're not going to badmouth them. But if you do, you're going to try to either delegitimize or somehow distinguish yourself since that you're no longer competition. Otherwise, you're fighting for the exact same market. So I think your points are both very well taken. Once you see that there is some fear of loss between one synagogue to another synagogue or one community to another community, that's when you start getting nervous, and that's when people can say you start playing dirty. And playing dirty can take any sort of forms. One can say, can we put them in cherem? Can we say, do some other stuff to be completely subversive?
Yeah.
It's possible to happen. Now, you can argue, again, we haven't actually gotten to any of the details behind it yet, because you could also, say, well, maybe they're like, you can say, hey, you're right, but wrong. Also, this isn't the Chacham Tzvi speaking. This is the question that was asked.
Yeah.
Okay, and it's very important because we haven't seen what he said on this yet. Right? And we'll see that one of the important distinctions that he's going to make is there's a distinction between the halakha about cherems, but also about what does this mean in practice today. Dana, could you read the paragraph that I translated that as the answer as follows? On page 2. Yes, I apologize. I was not, as I gave the disclaimer earlier, was not able to even come close to translating this whole thing coherently. But this part is well underlined, and you all have the Hebrew if you ever want to check me up on this. So go ahead.
And the answer is as follows. It is clear that the community's original agreement not to separate and pray with another quorum of 10 except in the original shul was proper and sustained on all individuals, and is impermissible for them to separate without the permission of the majority of the community. There's
okay.
A couple of double negatives there.
I understand. Well, that's the way a lot of things are written, but in the aspect of the cherem, if you set up the cherem, the communal decree, according to the Chacham Tzvi, and he elaborates this a little bit later in the Tshuva, you will need another decree to overturn it. Meaning,
the king is not sufficient.
Because the king didn't make the cherem. The cherem was made because of the king. And even if you have a new king and a new reality, his position is you need to have another formal decree to undo it.
In other words, it's the Jews that count. Forget about these kings. They got no say in our...
Well, because a cherem is a Jewish cultural exclusion. Yeah. It's not a civil court thing. Yeah. Right? But that's on one side. On the other hand, he goes off and he says, one second, let me hold it. I'm going to read like the other. Let me take over this. Dan, could you take over this other translation? This I got from the Third Circuit book as well, where he explains here as follows. If the results are, since sanctions were intended to, quote, promote religious practice and create fences around it, if results are the opposite and cause people to sin, then those who left the Portuguese synagogue had every right to act according to their consciences. In practice, he advised those who sought to join Ashkenazim to invite communal leaders who were preventing them from doing so to go before an impartial religious court and make their arguments. This included bringing responsum and support for separation. If the other party refused to come to such a Beit Din, based on his halachic opinion that those who wanted to leave the Portuguese community had every right to do so without formal permission. So the Chacham Tzvi, and we'll see his explanation, a quote translated by Fritziger in a second, La Halacha L'Ma'asa makes a distinction as follows. Yes, the original cherem, excommunication, is in place because that's what the community decided. If you want a dispensation from it, you need to go through due process, where you need, as he put it, an impartial Beit Din. What would impartial Beit Din be? You would not be able to have people who had vested interests in the success of, say, one community over another, but look at it on the merits. If you leave a shul, or you want to leave a shul, because you don't think that they're keeping halakha properly, well, that's up to you. That's your conscience. We spoke about being poreish min hatzibur, from leaving the congregation a few weeks ago, and we know that leaving a congregation is a really bad thing on one hand. On the other hand, if the congregation is violating Jewish law, then why would you stay there? Like, or to put it another way, what halachic reason would you be allowed to stay there? Dan, could you please take the paragraph here in terms of, you know, being able to split?
End of someone?
Yeah, end of someone.
And if someone should claim that it is permissible to pray with sinners until they have been to pray with
oh, right. You know what? We're just going to forget my typesetting here. Here, take it's in page 29 of the book, the direct quote there.
And if someone should claim that it is permissible to pray with sinners until they have been explicitly excommunicated,
thank you.
The answer is that this only refers to occasional transgressors among those who were denied a place in the world to come. But those who intentionally and without remorse throw off the burden of the commandments, even regarding an easy, simple act, such as a person, and particularly a public Sabbath desecrator, who is as a Gentile in all ways, how can it be possible for such a person to go up and read from the Torah? There is no greater desecration of God's name and dousing of the fire of religion. And anyone who is standing and present at that time in that place and does not protest will be caught up in his sins and lend support for his transgressions. And if the spirit of purity has possessed a few individuals who were zealous for the sake of the God of hosts to leave that place so that they should not be swept away with the sins of the others, on them shall a blessing be placed. Thus, any man whose heart has been touched by God has the right to separate and leave that congregation and pray with a quorum in whatever place that he chooses.
All right, so this gives us a very different spin on things, which is, if you think that the community is doing something wrong, then by all means, like, pack up and go. Here he happens to be talking about something very explicit about public Sabbath desecration. You know, but you could also see, you know, if this could be applied to other things as well. Yeah.
There's something very objectionable in my mind about this condemning public Sabbath desecrators.
Mm-hmm.
Guy goes out of shul, jumps on a bus, and somebody else, a yenta, says, oh, he jumped on a bus, don't let him back in the shul. What kind of crap?
So it's a good point. The truth is, you could probably do a paper alone just on what it meant to be Mechalel Shabbat B'Farhesia. In the time of the Gemara, it's already mentioned as if you break Shabbat in public, you are considered as outside of the Jewish community. I think we saw that inside in some place. But in the rabbinic mindset, and this held true for Jewish societies for many generations, when you lived in kind of a ghetto, where if you violated Shabbat in public, it wasn't that you're just doing your own thing, you're being in your face about it and saying, haha, I'm not keeping Shabbat. And you're making a statement with your actions that removes you from the Jewish community. In more contemporary period, I believe the Chazon Ish said, today, many people who, even if they break Shabbat in public, don't have that same halachic status, but rather they would come under the category of Tinok Shenishba, which is they simply don't know better. Tinok Shenishba means like an infant who is captured, meaning if you weren't raised about keeping Shabbat, then you're not so much rejecting it. And if you weren't raised in a Jewish community, it no longer has the same social force, even though people who cited are using the same Gemara, it's kind of changed. Now, what things were like in the 16 and 1700s, I'm not quite sure, but it certainly is different today, where you have enough people who weren't raised being Sabbath observant. If they do stuff, would they have the same halachas mechalel Shabbat b'farhesia? Harder to say today, because it doesn't mean the same today as it did back then. Right. Mm-hmm. So if you did it then, it would be a lot more brazen and a lot more in your face.
I would move to Paris or some sophisticated city where I could do what I want.
Well, and that's what a few people, and we'll deal with that a little bit later when we get to, you know, yeah.
So what if a guy had said to himself a couple of 100,000 years ago, these people over here, they think that they can light a candle before Shabbos and have light in their house, even though it says you can't have fires burning on Shabbat,
mm-hmm.
and these people are going around the laws of lending with their crucible. They're heretics. I don't want to sin. Uh-huh. Why they sin?
Sounds like a Karaite for your talking.
Not only would I say that, but you can easily see how if you have a dispute over actual halacha. I mean, let's not forget that Sfaradim and Ashkenazim, I mean, you could argue that they too have their own Shulchan Arks, where, you know, Sfaradim have, you know, Maran HaKadosh, you know, the Shulchan Aruch, and Ashkenazim have the Ramah. Maybe say, oh, you know, this is completely different. And in fact, Rav Tamler once said, you can't quote Shulchan Aruch to Ashkenazim, because Ashkenazim, he's the Mechaber, which means he was the author. Great, he wrote a book. Lots of people wrote books. But to Sfaradim, he's Maran HaKadosh, which is the holy master. Anyway, slight thing there. So if you want to say, you know, it's interesting also that he's not talking here about even minhag, which is fascinating in its own right, but something today that I know people are very obsessed about, like how could you go to a different place and change your minhag, doesn't really seem to enter into it. It's more a matter of this cherem, this community cherem that was established, that hasn't been overturned, and being able to pack up and leave. Right, but it's not. No one's saying like, "Oh, you should stick, you know, minhag avotechem b'yadechem." Like, stick with your family minhag and your tradition. It's more of, well, keeping Jewish law. Go to whichever place you think is keeping Jewish law better, and if they don't want to tell it, they don't want to, you know, deal with it at all. So here, even though I set this up as Sfaradim versus Ashkenazim, it seems to be a very interesting question that someone like Chacham Tzvi, having bounced around a lot, would be able to have a certain appreciation for. Because for him, these boundary lines of Sfaradim, once Sfaradim bad, Ashkenazim good, and here Sfaradim being the bad side or vice versa, doesn't really enter into it. It's more of, are you keeping Shabbos? Or if they're not keeping Shabbos, or they're not thinking halacha seriously, go. He's also not rejecting this shul as a whole. He's not saying, as far as I can tell, that, you know, it's an illegal shul. What he is saying is that, and again, this is where it gets a little bit interesting. You're talking about, for lack of a better term today, a non-observant Orthodox shul. Because you didn't have a distinction between Orthodox and conservative, and you didn't have it as a institutionalized within Sephardi Judaism not to keep Shabbat. To my, you know, that's my understanding of Sephardi in any sense, be it, you know, actual Spanish or Eidot HaMizrach, no one says you don't have to keep Shabbat, but not everyone does everything they're supposed to. And I think even as a... I think it also gives a very fascinating distinction. You also mentioned by Fritziger in the book here that you've got a tshuva on another Jewish community accepting its legitimacy or authenticity when they are not a distinct Jewish entity. They only have a different halachic tradition. And it's just being manifest in a way where not everyone is doing what they're supposed to do. And it's a unique quirk that you don't get to see all that often. Or at least not today, especially when, you know, people are so much more hung up on minhag of X versus minhag of Y, as opposed to, well, where can I actually keep halacha the best? Get that? Mm-hmm. To me, I find that point fascinating.
But you still didn't answer my question. Doesn't this justify the Karaites?
Doesn't this justify Karaites? In a sense...
Because they're saying that, you know, that the rabbinic community is violating the Torah.
I'd have to read a lot more Karaitic works to really get that. In terms of validating, operating under certain assumptions of rabbinic Judaism. And yes, and I will have no problem accepting that as a, you know, personal preference as a premise. And yes, that is a bias of mine. You know, for the Karaites, or even the Minim, or everyone who disagreed with the sages, in theory, you could. I mean, we've seen that for the subgroups, I think the Tzedukim, we've seen it too, wasn't just a matter of, you know, we don't believe in what you're doing, it's, we think you rabbi sages are incorrect on big issues. It just so happened that, this rabbis, either you can say that the rabbis won, or that the Judaism that we worship today is specific. Specifically rabbinic Judaism, and that's what we follow. Yes, and then yes.
Is there a Karaite shul in New York City? I would get a kick out of checking it out.
I've heard of them. I've never been. I would search the internet. Mm. Let's put it this way. I wouldn't be surprised if you found one.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay. Practical application here on the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
There's 7 or 8 Orthodox shuls within walking distance.
Yeah.
And... there are little variances
mm-hmm.
between shuls. So somebody comes in from out of town, looks at all 7 shuls. Well, this one doesn't quite do that right. And this one has this particular shtick. And this one, this mechitza, is the right.
Mm-hmm.
So how does one make that determination objectively? At the, you know, this one starts at 10 o'clock because that's the midnight.
Ideally? So ideally... I believe that there's an objective halakha where you can hold everyone accountable to, and, you know, under the assumption that no shul does everything appropriately. I don't think there is a single shul where everything that goes on in the shul the rabbi approves of. I don't think that exists.
Sure.
So you first have to say what's real. You first have to understand what's real halakha, and then say, well, what am I most comfortable with? Not everyone's going to do that, and you usually just skip to the second point of where am I most comfortable with. There's a joke, I forget even who was the first person who said it, that something like, the people I can talk to I can't daven with, and the people I daven with I can't talk to. And in fact, you know, somebody who comes to the shul goes to one shul because he likes the spirituality there, but politically he can't speak to anyone around him. That's one reason why he comes here. Not even so much that he agrees with the people in the shul, because people disagree with him from time to time, but the fact that he can at least have a discussion and a real discussion with people, you know, which is a great thing about this shul. People, how do people make decisions for that? I would guess wherever they happen to be more welcomes. Look, some people pick a shul because they have better cholent. And I actually know people who go to a particular minyan in the neighborhood because they have cholent every Shabbos. You know,
arrived,
what are you going to do?
For the Kiddush.
No. People don't do that as much here, at least for the Kiddush. They daven there for a long time. It's like, okay, we get Kiddush afterwards.
Uh-huh.
Or even if you don't like the hashgaf of the shul, maybe you just like the way they daven better. Around the corner, if it's on Sofer, from what I can tell, it's a hashgama minyan that starts at 8 o'clock. They're out at, you know, 10:30, quick, no fuss, no muss.
8:45, we're having, and they have chalent by 10:20.
You know what? That's an attract. That type of davening is a huge attraction to a lot of people. When I was in Washington Heights, I used to daven at Hashgama for that very reason. You know, so in terms of why people pick communities, you know, in order to really understand what, if you want to do due diligence, you have to spend a lot of time at the shul, getting to know all the people there, getting to know the rabbi, getting to know enough of the culture of the shul that can handle the people who go in and out. Most people don't know and don't care. And if you're talking about going, say, out to suburbia, trying a place to live, you first think about where can I afford the housing, where can I afford, like, or, you know, how is the schools, how's everything else involved, and then it's, can I tolerate the shul? But the truth is, shuls change so much so quickly, you know, based on demographics. If a rabbi leaves, you know, people have moved, it's not uncommon for you to move to a community because, you know, you really like the rabbi, and 2 years down the line, rabbi's contract doesn't get renewed. Not uncommon for that to happen. So, you know, in terms of, here's a little bit different because, you know, in this case here, you had one older tradition, you know, and I think this, you know, this tshuvah, you know, people would spend more time on it, you know, and really going through all the, you know, background. And the truth is, you know, it would be fascinating to see the whole background behind this communal situation, because you have the older Sephardi tradition, and then you've got Ashkenazi shuls popping up, when no one's saying, well, isn't the Minhag HaMakom only to have one? Like, even if you say that there was only one shul and there was a cherem against it and we didn't protest other shuls, the fact that no one said, you know, would get up and say, well, this is the custom of the town, you know, how could you have another competing one of Ashkenazi? You know, I think that there is an interesting backstory there, too, that I'd love to explore. Just I have no time for, you know, a long time to get into that, the Sephardi halachic divide. We're not going to spend so much time on that later because, truth be told, there isn't too, today, I don't think there is as much of an exclusion behind it. There's a lot of disagreement between Sephardim and Ashkenazim, but I don't think one says, I don't think you find someone saying is one side isn't Jewish, or with very few exceptions, one comes to mind, as one side not being authentically Jewish and just being incredibly dismissive. There are a lot of insults behind them. Like, I know some people from Midot Mizrach are very glib in insulting Ashkenazi practice, and I don't think they're wrong for doing so, but that's my own bias, the way that I was trained, and it depends for what, in terms of, like, a whole lot of stringencies that came up. And but the truth is, you know, in the Midot Mizrach culture, you have a lot of superstition as well. So part of it, I don't know if it's like, you know, friendly hawking, you know, you do that. But on the other hand, you know, since you have a very strong, passionate base on both sides, you're not going to find one side really trying to take on the other that often.
The rabbi training program at YU loaded Ashkenazi or Sephardi? Or
very much loaded Ashkenazi, because that's the demographic. Reality is that you've got more of those. Now, there are Sephardi options there. And in fact, that was the track that I took. It's changed. I'm only going to talk about when I was there. I know that the Smicha program has changed. But my first year in Smicha, I studied with Chacham Ben Chaim, who, for my money, is the most brilliant person on their faculty, without question. You're talking about someone who not only knows, you know, the Babylonian Talmud by heart, knows Rambam by heart, Shulchan Aruch by heart, he knows the Jerusalem Talmud by heart, which is really, really nuts. And it's not just that he knows it by heart, he integrates it seamlessly into the Gemara, where he says, oh, you know, you don't understand this point, he'll just, like, rattle off things. Seeing him in action is really just amazing. Mm-hmm. So he was someone with whom I studied. I studied with Rav Zevulun Lieberman, who, even though he is Ashkenaz, has a, I believe, a Syrian shul in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. So they do have, yeah.
I mean, the assistant principal at Flatbush when I was there was Sidney Lieberman.
That could very well be. Wouldn't make a great deal of sense. Would call him ancient, but, you know, he's not young. So they did have a Sephardic program, which, you know, the difference would be this. You know, when I did Nidah with him, we did Tarat Mishpacha, which was written by Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, you know, as a former Sephardi chief rabbi. So they do have programs there. You do have individuals that we would consider a Sephardi heritage. They would be in the minority because demographically, that's, you know, you don't really have that, or at least not around YU. Mm-hmm. And I don't know enough about the Sephardi community to know they have their own smicha. I would assume that there would be smicha programs, you know, from the Sephardi community, but I'm not a member there, and yeah.
Okay, is there any? I went through Psychoanalytic Institute where they were at loggerheads with each other, the Freudians and the Deesians and all that. Are the rabbis of Sparty and Ashkenazi at each other's throats? Politically?
It would depend whom and where. It wouldn't surprise me if certain people are picking fights, but also you need two people to pick a fight. Meaning that sometimes people say, like, we just don't care. If you really want to hear good anti-Ashkenazi rants, and I don't think you would mind saying this because it's a nice little plug, head on up to the 16th Street Shul, meet Rav Ephraim Gabay, former classmate of mine, also Rav Ben Chaim Shior. He is, well, he can be, like, really anti-Ashkenazi as you can get. He probably toned it down a bit, you know, since he's kind of a public figure. He gets along with a lot of people. But ideologically, if you want, like, a good anti-Ashkenaz rant, he is more than willing to provide and will be more than, and will do a good job of it. And it's not because of silliness. It's because, like, here are all the places where Ashkenazim have deviated from halakha.
Gotcha.
And there's no shortage of cases there. By deviated from halakha, I don't just mean, you know, it goes both ways. It means l'chumra and l'kula. And, you know, I said before here, if you follow straight Rambam consistently, you effectively have a very different religion. So a friend of mine actually got annoyed at the comment that I made last week about Chabad having their own Shulchan Aruch. But it's like, well, it's no different than, say, in another group. And I said, you know, it doesn't really matter, because at the end of the day, if I'm going to hold, you know, Chabad accountable to, say, you know, same as, say, Ramah or the Shach and the Taz, you know, even though Shachan doesn't write their own Shulchan Aruch, you know, they commented on their Shulchan Aruch and say, you're still doing a whole lot of things differently than might have been mandated by the Gemara. You know, Shechita is one of them. Chabad is their own, you know, standard for Shechita. Right? That, I didn't make that up. You know, and it's not to say that you're following, you know, the fact that you have a Shulchan Aruch, it makes it, you know, distinguishable, because you have the Aruch HaShulchan. You know, that was someone else's, you know, codification of things, but, you know, you can evaluate, well, how consistent are you with Torah Shabbat Peh? Now, and which is also why I put in the disclaimer, whatever deviations Chabad might have against Torah Shabbat Peh, would it be that qualifiably, you know, more different or more egregious than that you find amongst, you know, any other place?
I just want to throw this in. It's an anecdote. I remember I went to 770 once, and it's getting dark, and they haven't davened mincha yet. So I asked the guy sitting next to me, what's the story? What if they were waiting for the Rebbe? I said, what if the Rebbe doesn't come until midnight? We wait.
Alrighty. So leave that there. So with the next subsequent weeks, we're going to discuss more of the interactions between... we're going to do a more response on. We're going to deal with the threat of modernity. By modernity, I mean secularism. You know, some of the things that we've done before have been heresies of, like, you know, where people will say, like, heretic things against Judaism. Not to say with the modernity you wouldn't have that as well, but it's a specific challenge of people who try to adjust Judaism to challenges of modernity and secularization. You can argue with varying successes, but we'll deal with some of the exclusion part, well, specifically with the exclusion parts of what happens when in some person's mind another group goes too far, what are the arguments against it, and what's, for lack of a better term, the hyperbole used, and evaluate accordingly. So that's going to be the themes, like, for the next couple of weeks.
What are some of the dramatis personae that you're going to be...
Oh, Chassam Sofer is going to be one. Who, you know, can't have it without him. Do some more research myself to see if there are other, you know, if I can find some other good responsa. We'll definitely be doing a bunch in Rav Moshe, because he's got a bunch on the subject. You know, maybe get a couple of Rav Avad Yosef as well, because he also gets into, are you allowed to teach at JPS? Yeah, so we'll...
Sounds lively.
Oh, it's always going to be fun here. But it's just to keep people aware, if we're going to, next couple of weeks, we're going to be dealing with Tshuvot, which, again, for our purposes, are going to be, I think, very interesting, because they will show one person's opinion in the process of excluding another. we're not doing this to pass judgment of whether or not, you know, yes, you know, this is why they ought to be excluded, as much as seeing, here's who's doing the exclusion, here's the background, here's why, and then try to see whether or not, you know, does the argument make sense? How does this hold? Given the hindsight, the benefit of hindsight, you know, was this accurate or inaccurate? Mm. All right? So it's going to be a lot of fun. And in fact, you should know that these are the types of things that Ed initially wanted me to do for the class on. And it's just the more I thought about it, the more I figured, you know, we really need to spend some more time in the back. So Ed should be very happy. Anytime. Have a wonderful week. Oh, and for those interested, the Getting Shrichul Beit Midrash this Tuesday night at 7:30 is going to discuss drinking on Purim. And that, I promise you, is going to be a whole lot of fun, because even if you think you know it, well, it'll be my spin on it, which I wrote up several years ago. You can, I don't know, if you don't want to come, you can search my website for Drinking on Purim. Otherwise, we're going to go through everything in depth with sources. Have a wonderful week. Bye.